Hello and welcome to AUP Radio, a melting pot of voices and ideas, brought to you by World Radio Paris. Today we have two shows coming up. We'll start off with Have You Heard? And end off the night with Through the Lens. Enjoy!
Welcome to Have You Heard, a weekly rundown and analysis of the top news in U.S. and world politics. So the next time a water cooler conversation starts with Have You Heard, you can say yes. I'm Jacob Shropshire.
And I'm Erin Flanagan. This week we're going to be going over what's going on with some high-profile legal trials in the United States, the House vote on the Build Back Better plan, then finally an overview of the conflict breaking out in Ethiopia.
Just a quick disclaimer, all views and opinions expressed in this show represent our personal views and not that of any organization we're affiliated with.
Jake, there are a lot of big trials and legal decisions going on right now, and one of them just went down in your home state of Oklahoma with Julius Jones. What happened?
So Julius Jones was scheduled to be executed last Thursday on charges of killing a man named Paul Howell in 1999. Jones, his family, and millions of supporters have said that he's innocent. He also has support from a lot of high-profile people like Kim Kardashian, football player Baker Mayfield, and there's more than 6 million signatures on a change.org petition. The Howell family and the state prosecutors are still arguing that he's guilty, though, and so there was a lot of uncertainty around the case, and that's kind of the problem. It just wasn't clear-cut. So the Oklahoma Pardon and Parole Board voted 3-1 earlier this month for Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt to commute Jones' sentence. Two of the four people who voted were actually appointed by Stitt, and there was one person who was also appointed by Stitt who abstained for some kind of non-related reasons. Stitt did eventually commute the sentence, but it actually only happened a few hours before the execution was supposed to take place, so very much down to the wire.
Absolutely. And there were a lot of protests surrounding the execution, is that right?
Yeah, totally. There was thousands of protesters at the state capitol building from within Oklahoma and from outside of it. There were smaller protests around the country. I saw some in New York and D.C., stuff like that. Students in some of the schools in the OKC Metro actually walked out of school in protest. It was really moving to see, actually. People were calling and emailing the governor. I don't know all the statistics, but I know on the Tuesday before the execution was originally planned, the governor's office got more than 10,000 phone calls in one day, which is absolutely insane.
Yeah, it's amazing to watch how people mobilized around this issue. And Oklahoma has a bit of a complicated relationship with the death penalty. Can you give a brief history of that in Oklahoma?
It's definitely messy, that's for sure. Oklahoma's main form of execution is lethal injection. That's important because There's been some problems with that whole process. So in 2014, there was a botched execution where the IV basically wasn't put in properly. And so instead of being a relatively quick process, it actually lasted for 33 minutes, which was really horrible. And they tried to stop it halfway through, which caused even more problems. And so they temporarily put executions on hold. Then they got resumed in 2015, but right actually as they started redoing them, the chemicals for the executions got, they were like these massive, you know, nationwide shortages of them, meaning that they've essentially been halted for 7 years, the better part of it at least. So then in 2016, you know, just after a year, the year where they kind of restarted this and then there were the shortages, there was state question 776, which was on the question of executions and whether or not the state should uphold those. I mean, 2/3 of Oklahomans voted to uphold the death penalty. Earlier this year in October, John Grant was the first execution since 2015. That execution was highly problematic. The AP reporter on site, he had said that Grant had convulsed and threw up after getting the injections. And so the state kind of maintained that nothing had been done wrong and that it was just kind of a mishap in terms of this specific person. But after this execution, the Pardon and Parole Board has pretty publicly said that they want to see the system work better. And they've recommended the commutation of sentences of people they actually have said they think are guilty just by saying that the execution process is messed up right now.
Wow. So there's really a reckoning around the death penalty in Oklahoma going on.
Yeah, for sure.
And what was the sense on the ground locally about everything?
Well, obviously I'm not there right now, so I can't say exactly how everything is, but all my friends and family who live there, I've talked to them and they say it just kind of feels weird right now, which I'm sure. I mean, this whole subject feels really weird and kind of morbid. I've talked to some people who say that they know people on the Pardon and Parole Board, and they've said that basically though those people do lean a little bit conservative, they're actually still pretty reasonable people. They're pretty apolitical, and which is a good thing on this kind of issue. But these protests were actually a huge deal. Protests like this don't really happen all that often, and certainly not of this magnitude. We don't get people coming from out of state to protest in Oklahoma. That just doesn't happen very often. And equally impressive was the fact that there seemed to be relatively little political leadership in them. So obviously, like, the Democratic leaders in the state House and Senate were there, and they were supporting the protests. But they were far from leading them. They were just kind of there in support. The real leader of the protest was actually the mother of Julius Jones, who she's a teacher in Oklahoma. And she gave some actually really moving speeches talking about the things that they've, you know, faced while dealing with this that are, if you give a chance, totally worth checking out. And then, you know, the relief that washed through when the governor commuted the sentence was insane. I was following it all on Twitter, like, minute by minute. I was literally trying not to put my phone down for more than 5 minutes. I had to go take a shower, and I got back from my shower, and, like, then all of this, you know, my feed was full of this sort of sense of relief that he had commuted the sentence, which was a really, really big deal, especially since it was so close to the wire.
Oh, it's nice to see an outcome like that. We're also going to talk about two more cases with a slightly different outcome in one of them, starting with Kyle Rittenhouse, the now 18-year-old who fatally shot two people and injured another during protests last year in Kenosha, Wisconsin. This trial was highly watched and touched on a lot of questions that the U.S. is divided on right now, including guns rights, violence at racial justice protests, and vigilantism. Jake, what was the outcome of this trial?
On Friday, the jury delivered a verdict of not guilty on all 5 charges. Rittenhouse's defense claimed he was acting in self-defense, and so that was, you know, that's what they decided.
Yeah, that's right. Jurors deliberated for about 27 hours before pronouncing Rittenhouse not guilty on all 5 of those counts, including first-degree intentional homicide.
Can you give us a little bit more background on the night that is in question?
Yeah, so as a refresher, Rittenhouse armed himself with an AR-15 rifle on a night of protests last year in Kenosha, Wisconsin, following the police shooting of Jacob Black, a 29-year-old black man who was left paralyzed from the shooting. Rittenhouse lived across the state line in Illinois and allegedly came to the protest to act as a medic and protect private property.
So how did he end up shooting 3 people?
There's a lot of video evidence out there showing the shootings, and during the trial, Rittenhouse said he reasonably feared for his life, saying that he was chased and those chasing him were grabbing for his weapon.
even though he was acquitted on criminal charges, could there still be civil lawsuits?
Yeah, prosecutors claimed that Rittenhouse created the dangerous situation by choosing to bring a rifle into that environment, but the jury was not swayed by this argument. The state needed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that his actions that night were not reasonable and that he didn't believe that deadly force was needed to defend himself, and they weren't able to do that. He could still be sued for damages in a civil trial. Jake, how did Biden react?
Biden released a statement saying that many Americans will feel angry and concerned, but he also said that, you know, we must acknowledge that the jury has spoken. Going forward, is there anything else we should be watching?
Yes, definitely. The acquittal has been met with joy by online far-right extremist groups. While Rittenhouse is not known to be a member of any extremist group, the trial has been a rallying point for those who champion gun rights. Experts are worried that his acquittal may embolden others to engage in this type of violence, and some could see his trial as permission to commit violence and invoke self-defense. On baseline, this could also encourage more members of the far right to be visible at these types of events.
We're watching a third case involving vigilantism that's pretty close to this, actually. The case over the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. Travis McMichael and his father, Gregory McMichael, and their neighbor, William Bryan, are facing murder charges after they chased Arbery, a black man, through a neighborhood in Georgia. Okay. Sorry. We do make typos in our ad copy, in our copies. And they shot him to death, unfortunately. This is another case in which the defense is arguing that Travis McMichael acted in self-defense when they were attempting to conduct a citizen's arrest.
Tell us more about the citizen's arrest aspect.
Yeah, so the three men on trial said they were trying to arrest Arbery under their suspicion that he may have stolen something from an under-construction house.
That's right. Arbery was 25 years old, running through a neighborhood in Georgia, and this case, like Rittenhouse's, is also being closely watched for its nexus to some of those same issues, guns rights, intense protests over racial inequality in the U.S. His family is calling his killing a modern-day lynching.
Have there been any notable moments so far in the trial?
The jury has been a point of contention. It took nearly 3 weeks for it to be selected, and it ended up including 11 white people and one black person. And black potential jurors had made up one-fourth of the final juror pool. So both the defense and prosecution have rested, and closing arguments will start today, that is Monday.
Yeah, hopefully that ends up going the way, going towards justice.
Yeah, exactly. Last week, the U.S. House of Representatives, switching topics now, voted along near party lines to approve the approximately $1.2 trillion social and climate spending package. The vote was 220 to 213, with one Democrat, Republican Jared Golden of Maine, joining the Republicans in opposition. Jake was in this bill.
Yeah, so this was a big way for Biden and Democrats generally to fulfill 2020 campaign promises. It contains a lot of money to address climate change, and it provides a stronger federal safety net for families and low-income workers. So here's the basic breakdown of it. It's got $550 billion for climate change through incentive and tax breaks, which, you know, as we kind of learned from the COP26 side of things, that's really important. It's got funding to extend the monthly child credit, which is a big deal. It's got housing assistance, expansions to Medicaid, 4 weeks of paid family and medical leave, which is a big deal. Universal pre-K funding, and it caps monthly insulin expenses at $35, which is a massive deal, massive win.
Yeah, that's a wish list for the Democrats right there in a nutshell. So Democrats were able to overcome internal divisions over the cost and scope of this bill, but now it is heading to the Senate. The vote was delayed after House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy spoke for more than 8 hours, a record for the longest speaking filibuster in the history of the House. But ultimately, the Congressional Budget Office came back with a score, finding that the bill will cost the government $367 billion over the next decade. But Dems are arguing that with additional funding for tax enforcement, the bill will pay for itself.
How's Biden reacting to all of this?
Biden praised the House, saying it was the second time in 2 weeks that they moved through a consequential piece of his legislative agenda, referring back to the infrastructure bill we chatted about a couple weeks ago. The spending for this bill will largely be offset with taxes on the wealthy and corporations. So, Jake, what are the next steps for this bill?
Yeah, so next it has to head to the Senate, which, as we know, our favorite people are in, and they're, you know, they certainly make this process easy. I'm, of course, kidding, because this is going to almost certainly involve some further changes. Sinema and Manchin are expressing concerns over the House version of the legislation. Manchin specifically is he's against the 4 weeks of family, paid family and medical leave. So Senate Majority Whip Dick Durbin of Illinois, he told NPR that he expects Dems to pass the bill by the end of the year. I think Chuck Schumer was slightly more optimistic. He was saying before Christmas, but they have sort of the same timeline generally.
If journalists got paid every time they said mansion and cinema, we might be able to pay for this bill ourselves.
Honestly.
So it's unclear how long it will take for senators to finalize the legislation. Then it has to go through a lengthy process where they vote on the bill using the budget reconciliation process. Again, just as a reminder, that would allow the Senate to pass it with 50 votes and not 60 as is needed for most legislation. So this is showing momentum for Democrats after months of infighting and headlines saying Democrats in disarray. But Jake, what does this mean for Biden's economic agenda?
Yeah, there are some concerns about inflation and sort of an overheated economy. And that's part of the conversation against the Build Back Better is saying that this legislation is sort of not a stimulus. It's meant to be spent over years and years. Republicans are saying it's too big and too expensive, even though they're trying to it's going back to their communities and they're going and bragging about the infrastructure bill, even when they voted no for it. Saw my representative the other day was saying stuff about it, which I'm like, you voted against this, which is very frustrating. So, you know, the inflation discussion, I think, is going to be really important going forward and talking about how this is actually even partly. I think Democrats can make an argument that this is a way to combat the effects of inflation. If I'm a family that has a little bit of extra money in my pocket, that helps me deal with rising prices. It doesn't actually hurt them. And so I think that's a big deal. This is also kind of all tied up in this upcoming debt ceiling vote and the continuing resolution in December here coming up soon.
It is going to be a busy December, and we will be here covering it for you.
No doubt. Now we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more Have You Heard?
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to AUP Radio, brought to you by World Radio Paris. Now back to Have You Heard?
Welcome back to Have You Heard? There is a civil war in Ethiopia that started about a year ago. Both the government-backed forces and rebel forces have been accused of human rights abuses, and the conflict itself is creating a huge humanitarian crisis. Jake, how did this get started?
So back in 2018, Prime Minister Abiy took office and has been actively reducing the power and influence of the TPLF, of which he was once a member, which has infuriated Tigrayan leadership. They retreated to the northern region of Ethiopia, and tensions have just been escalating ever since. Then a year ago, the TPLF forces attacked a federal military base in Tigray, and hours later, Abiy ordered a military offensive on the Tigrayan leadership.
Yeah, this conflict has left thousands dead and forced more than 2 million people from their homes. Fighters from Ethiopia's northern Tigray region and their allies have been rebelling against government-backed forces. Now, this tide has recently shifted in favor of the rebel forces, who are now pushing south toward the capital city of Addis Ababa. And there are a lot of signs showing that several Ethiopian army units have collapsed or retreated.
What does this all mean for the regional stability of the region?
A humanitarian crisis worsening across the country in the form there's, you know, kids who are don't have enough nutrition, there's famine, there's starvation, and some are calling the forced migration of tens of thousands in western Tigray an ethnic cleansing campaign. Until recently, Ethiopia was seen as a strategic linchpin of the Horn of Africa, but many experts are concerned that it will create instability in an already volatile part of the continent.
Didn't Prime Minister Abiy just win a Nobel Peace Prize?
He sure did, back in 2019 when he made peace with Eritrea, a longtime enemy of Ethiopia. But since then, his rhetoric and actions have hardened throughout the conflict. Jake, how is the U.S. reacting?
Yeah, so Secretary of State Antony Blinken has recently visited Africa, including a stop in Kenya near Ethiopia. The U.S. has been trying unsuccessfully to find some diplomatic solutions and especially to allow aid to enter the country, which is a huge deal. This is also in the middle of a recent military takeover in Sudan, so there's a lot of pressure in the Horn of Africa building up right now, which is critical for the U.S.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on this conflict as it goes forward, but hoping for a quick solution to this problem. Switching gears for our quick news update. Yesterday, someone driving an SUV plowed into a Christmas parade in Waukesha, Wisconsin. The police have taken one person into custody. Five people have been confirmed dead from the attack, and another 40 were injured.
Days after President Biden told world leaders at COP26 that the U.S. was committed to slowing climate change, the Interior Department oversaw one of the largest oil and gas lease sales in U.S. history, 80 million acres in the Gulf of Mexico. The Biden administration argues it didn't have a choice after a federal judge in Louisiana sided with a dozen Republican-led states filed lawsuits challenging Biden's pause of new oil and gas leasing.
Last week, lawmakers in the House censured GOP Representative Paul Gosar of Arizona over an anime video he shared depicting a character that looked like him, killing another meant to represent Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York. Most Republicans did not defend the video, but thought that the censure went too far. Gosar, who will lose his committee assignments, did not express regret, nor did he apologize. Only two Republicans voted for the censure, being Representative Liz Cheney and Representative Adam Kinzinger.
An Arizona man named Jacob Chansley, the self-proclaimed QAnon shaman, you might have seen pictures of him during the Capitol siege, was sentenced to 41 months in prison for his role in the U.S. Capitol riot.
China and the U.S. agreed to ease travel and visa restrictions on each other's journalists. This move will allow journalists to enter or depart from both countries more freely, which is seen as progress between the two countries, who have seen relations between the two decline over the recent years. These new policies come as a result of last week's meeting between President Biden and President Xi Jinping, which were meant to stem the rising tensions between the two countries.
That's all we have for this week. If you want to continue the conversation, you can hit us up on Twitter. I'm at JD Shropshire.
And I'm at Aaron K. Flanagan. This has been Have You Heard? We'll talk at you next week.
See you next week.
Welcome to Through the Lens. Today is a special episode because actually I will be mostly talking about one book that I can firmly say has changed my life. It's called Atomic Habits by James Clear. Also in one of my classes here at AUP, my graduate classes, we have to write some pieces on different topics, and I wanted to turn this one into sort of podcast since I already have this show going, and to kind of turn one of my pieces into my episode / podcast for Peacock. Peacock. Sorry, I don't know why I'm laughing. Everybody's a little bit delusional today. I don't know if it's just me, but I've been sleeping great for some reason. Anyway, off topic. But yes, I thought that this would be worth not just writing an article about it, just because I could go into a lot more detail on why this book has been so influential. Not only do I want to do a quick review on it, but I also want to take some of the main wisdom nuggets that I got from it, just so you can kind of, like, I would still recommend to read it, but I think it even helps me. Like, I took so many notes while I was reading this book, because I just think it's one of those books that you just need to not only take notes, but kind of be refreshing yourself constantly. And I'll probably have it as a little Bible for myself throughout my life to just remind myself how to get back on track with anything, because you can really just apply it to any kind of aspect of your life that you want to change. So in terms of a review, I think it's such a fun, quick read. It's one of those books that you can kind of just get lost in it, which I personally think is kind of rare for a self-help book, because I mean, I've read so many and I think a lot of topics have been overdone. And I don't know, like his writing style is just digestible. And he starts each chapter with a sort of story from like some famous writer or like somebody he knows. Like normally it's like some historical or influential person kind of talking about, like fitting it into his tip for creating habits. And it's just so well written. And I like the way that it's structured, because essentially there's four tips and four main tips that I will get into. And he just kind of like flows so easily through them, because not only is he teaching you how to build habits, but he's also teaching you how to break bad habits and a lot more information on habits in general. So, yeah, obviously review. This is going to be like the shorter part of the episode. For me, it was 10 out of 10. I, like I said, just such an easy read. I read it within like a week, while also doing like a lot of other readings for class. But it's just one of those books that you kind of can't put, you look forward to reading it. And so I think everybody could get something from it, even if you already have really good habits in place. There's always room for improvement to even expand on the habits that you've already created. So I think one of the main points that I loved about this book was that small habits make a big difference. Success is in the details and ritual of everyday choices. And he gave this really good example that even if we only improved, because I think what he was trying to say is we think that, you know, like let's say you have a hat, like you want to create a habit of meditating for 5 minutes a day. To your mind, you might be like, oh, it's so short, 5 minutes. Like, what's that going to do? But he basically starts off the book by explaining how even just 1% of something positive will compound to 37% over the year. And he explains how this can happen so easily with bad habits. Like, let's say you are just binge eating twice a week, going over your caloric maintenance, and you're pushing so hard at the gym, but you just don't know why. Even though you're only doing this like binge, even once a week, like going, you know, we don't realize how these little bad habits, or let's say every time after lunch, you like eat 10 Oreos without even realizing it because it's become a habit because the cookie jar is right next to your office. And you don't realize that 3 months later, you know, you've gained 10 pounds. And that's just like, I don't know, I just thought of that example. And I think he kind of gave a similar example of, you know, there's just as 5 simple minutes of meditating can compound so effectively into your life. Also, little bad habits can also be so detrimental in the long run. Be far more contented with current trajectory than with your current results. Mastering a new skill is vital because the more tasks your brain can do without thinking, the more your brain is free to focus on other areas. So this is really interesting because he kind of is trying to explain one of my favorite things that kind of put everything into perspective. Because when I read this, I kept questioning the sort of things that I was doing and being really hard on myself. But he's kind of just like, look, it's not so much about the end goal, because when you really realize it and you achieve a goal, it's not that that makes you happy. Like, eventually it will lose its significance. It's the systems in place that created that goal that will drive your life, essentially. And breakthrough moments are often the result of many previous actions which build up the potential, and that's what requires a major change. And habits often appear to make no difference until you cross a critical threshold and unlock a new level of performance. And he has like this really awesome graph in his book where he's explaining this threshold, which I just think is so interesting, because I think it's so true. Like, when you're building a habit, let's say you're doing it for 2 months every day and you're not feeling the positive effects yet, but if you just keep going, like, it's really, once you're about to give up is really when you start seeing the results. And he kind of explains it because it's just this persistence that you need to break through, where boom, it kind of all clicks into your head. Like, whether you're trying to master writing and you're writing for 30 minutes every day and you're not getting any creativity, but you're just writing, trying to get your thoughts across. And then finally, there's a point 4 months later when, boom, like, you just realize, oh my goodness, I have this great idea for blank story. And basically, another awesome part of this book is that he's kind of explaining how it's not really the habit itself that matters. It's the identity around the habit that is the most important to the ego and to yourself, because it's not actually that you want to run a marathon. It's that you want to be a runner. You want to be the sort of person that is a trainer. You want to be the sort of person that's determined. You want to be the sort of person that's athletic. And I think that's so true, because we look at the goal's face value, but it's not really about that. It's really about how you see yourself. You know, if you're trying to lose weight, you see yourself as someone who is right now overweight, out of shape, and you want to be someone who doesn't struggle with their weight, is in shape, and is considered healthy. Like, that's really your end goal, is how you feel. And so I think it's really cool that he starts off with this in the beginning, because then you put the pressure off of the goal of, like, I want to lose 20 pounds or I want to write a whole entire book. And you just kind of realize, oh no, like, I just want to change my identity from I feel overweight and bad to I am someone who's in shape and in control of my body, or I want to be a writer, or I want to write a book, to I want to be, like, I am a writer and I write every day and I am on the way of writing my first book. Like, that's really, like, the sort of thought process that you want. Another aspect of the book that he's widely known for is his focus on systems. He says, forget about the goals and focus on the systems. Goals are good for setting a direction, but systems are best for making progress. The problems arise when you focus on goals and not enough time on designing your systems. Winners and losers have the same goals. Achieving a goal only changes your life for the moment. We think we need to change our results, but the results are not the problem. What we really need to change are the systems that cause those results. Goals restrict your happiness, and once you reach them, doesn't mean you'll stay happy. Goals first mentality is that you're continually putting off until the next milestone. You have to fall in love with the process rather than the product. You don't have to wait to give yourself permission to be happy. And I thought this was so beautiful, and it just clicked so much in my head, because I think I've talked about this in the past, but for me, a huge passion of mine is health and fitness. And I think, like, for example, I work with a nutritionist in Brazil, and she is in such amazing shape. She's such a expander, motivator to me. Her and her sister are both just incredible. Like, her sister is a doctor, and they're just so involved in, like, their community with fitness and health. And people are always asking her, like, how do you stick to such a healthy, you know, meal plan and lifestyle and go to the gym all the time? And she's like, because I don't see it as a beginning to an end. It's not, oh, it's a 4-week plan or it's a 10-month, you know what, like, she's like, it's a way of life. And I think that's what he's kind of saying too here, is that You can't keep seeing it as a milestone. Like, yeah, you got to keep yourself motivated and goals are important, but you have to fall in love with the systems, because then what's the point? You know, if you really want to be somebody like, for example, like me, that I want to get to the point where my health and my fitness is just so much ingrained in me that I am just someone who radiates like this health and fitness, and that I'm, you know, in this like top shape, and kind of like I said, like my nutritionist, who for her it's no beginning or end, it's just a way of life, it's a process that you're just committed to. Most people don't consider identity change. They set goals and determine the actions they should take to achieve those goals without considering the beliefs that drive their actions. They'd never shift the way they look at themselves, and they don't realize that their old identity can sabotage their new plans for change. It's hard to change your habits if you never change the underlying beliefs that led to your past behavior. And I think this is what I explained in my last episode when I was talking about affirmations. And this is literally what he's talking about right here, and why I think it's so important when you're trying to start any new habit, whether it's weight loss, writing, and I keep going to those two examples, but I mean, you really have to start changing your thought process, because that's essentially what's going to lead to you doing these habits without even, you know, a second thought.
For any listeners that are just tuning in, you're listening to AUP Radio, brought to you by World Radio Paris. Now back to Through the Lens.
The ultimate form of intrinsic motivation is when a habit becomes part of your identity. It's one thing to say I'm the type of person who wants this, and different to say I'm the type of person who is this. So that kind of goes back to it. It's like the goal is not to lose weight. It's to become a person who sustains health and confidence throughout their life. The goal is not to read a book. The goal is to become a reader. I mean, this is really like the main... I don't know. I just, for me, that was kind of a breakthrough just reading this, because it really kind of calms your mind and lets you forgive yourself for any past identities, and that you're able to shift these identities with enough work. And to create a new identity, he says you need new evidence. Number one, you need to decide the type of person who you want to be. Number two, you got to prove it to yourself with small wins. What type of person do you want to be? Do you want to be a person who reads? Are you a person who studies? Are you a person who's healthy? Are you a person who creates, writes? Or are you a person who meditates? Like, you got to ask yourself, like, and this is what, you know, in the sort of habits you want. Like, for me, something that I've been, like, I want to be a person who reads. Like, even though, yes, I read a couple of books a year and I'm in school, like, that's one of the habits that I'm trying to implement into my life, is every single day, read at least 20 minutes. And then slowly and surely, and I even feel this now from implementing this habit for a month, that my brain is starting to really believe in that, and that I am a reader, and that I am someone who reads. And I can confidently say, like, if I'm, you know, having coffee with a friend, I feel like before I'd feel like a fraud if I was like, oh, I'm a reader and I have books to recommend and a Goodreads account. Like, I would feel like a fraud. But I think if you're integrating it into your daily life or weekly life, it's so true. It just becomes a part of your identity, and it makes you, and it's a beneficial habit to have. You know, you got to ask yourself, what do you want to stand for in your life? Like, what are your principles and values? Who do you wish to become? Yeah. Okay. So I really, you know, I would really recommend, like I said, read this. But the process of building habits, there's basically, so he kind of goes into detail on how it's kind of a cue, a craving, a response, and rewards. So he really breaks down these aspects of, you know, creating habits and stuff like that, which I won't go too into. I'm going to go more into his four laws on creating habits. So the first law is make it obvious. Many of our failures in performance are largely attributed to a lack of self-awareness. So we need a point and call system for our personal lives. Make a list of your daily habits. Is this a good habit? Is it a bad habit? Is it a neutral habit? Observe without judgment. So I love this. And I went through this in my own like day and I just kind of wrote down the habits that I had and either put a check mark if it was beneficial, if it was neutral, you know, like getting up and brushing your teeth. I mean, actually not the good one, but like, let's say you get up and you glob, you know, you go to the bathroom. I mean, that would be just like a neutral one. And then let's say you check your phone first thing in the morning. That would be a negative habit, at least in my opinion. And then say out loud the action that you are thinking of taking and what the outcome will be. Acknowledge the cues that trigger them, implementation intent, a plan you make beforehand about when and where to act, how you intend to implement a particular habit. Most common cues are location. I will blank at blank time in blank location. So this is like one of his tips for creating habits. So like being like, I will read at 8 a.m. in my bed when I first wake up, for example. Like if you're somebody that's trying to create a new morning routine and want to incorporate reading into that, just saying that and being so, he kind of explains how we really need to be so specific about where, when, so our brain is not just like, you know, like don't make it ambiguous, be very specific. And that's the first one. Make it obvious. Or like if you're trying to drink more water, literally, this is what I do. I put a big, I drink about like 1 liter in the morning and I just have like a 1 liter water bottle right there. And I'm like, oh yeah. And I have my vitamins right there. And these are all tips from his book. Like make it so obvious. Like if you're trying to not be on your phone, literally put your phone across the room when you're sleeping. So when you wake up, you're like, oh yeah, it's so far away. And then your book is right next to your bed. He also explains habit stacking, which each action becomes a cue that triggers the next behavior. One of the best ways to build a new habit is to identify a current habit you already do each day. So like after I brush my teeth, I will blank new habit. So cutting off bad habits, make it invisible, cut off at the source, reduce exposure to the cue that it causes, make it invisible. Self-control is a short-term strategy. It's unlikely you can muster the willpower to override your desire every time. This is a secret to self-control. Make the cues of your good habits habits obvious and the cures of your bad habits invisible. For example, I'm eating really clean right now, which has actually helped me a lot because I already kind of suffer with some digestive issues just from moving abroad. And I've realized like ever since going back onto my like going to my nutritionist and having a plan, I feel my energy levels are better. I'm sleeping better. I'm not having any gut issues. And so I do not buy anything in my apartment that I know will cause inflammatory or digestive issues. So it's not even a part of my, like I can't, even if I wanted to, indulge in those. So that's a perfect example. So the second law, make it attractive. The more attractive an opportunity is, the more likely it is to become a habit forming. The dopamine-driven feedback loop plays a role in pleasure, motivation, learning, and memory. Punishment and aversion and voluntary movement. Dopamine is released not only when you experience pleasure, but when you anticipate it. So you can do temptation bundling, linking an action you want to do with an action you need to do. So after I would do it like this. After I finish my homework, I will watch Friends because I love watching Friends lately. And I've been doing this, you know, for like things that I really want to do, like, or if I really want to talk to a friend on the phone, I'll be like, okay, after I meditate, I will then call my best friend and like gossip. Also the role of family and friends, like he talks about it in this chapter, we imitate a lot of the people that we're around. So really picking your groups wisely. Like, for example, since I'm trying to get more into the fitness scene here and kind of get away from like the party scene, I've kind of put more priority on my friends that love going to like fitness classes with me, meditation classes, or like trying healthy like vegan spots. So really surrounding yourself with people that align to the habit that you're trying to form. And it doesn't mean that you can't see your friends that are different, but you're just prioritizing being around people that really do embody that sort of person you want to be. And then when it terms, when it takes, when it, like, he kind of, like, in each chapter, he's teaching you how to get closer to creating a habit and then also how to take away bad habits. So for this one, for law number two, for breaking a habit, it's make it unattractive. You have to basically reprogram your brain to enjoy hard habits. Change the language from, like, don't say I have to, but I get to. You shift the way you view each event. Reframing your habits to highlight their benefits rather than their drawbacks is a fast and lightweight way to reprogram your mind and make a habit seem more attractive. It's time to build strength and get lean. Example of shifting the mindset. Also, the third law is make it easy. You need to get the reps in. The best is the enemy of good. Motion doesn't lead to results. Actions do. The biggest reason why you skip into motion rather than taking action is you want to delay failure. When preparation becomes a form of procrastination, you need to change something. You don't want to be merely planning. You want to be practicing. To master a habit, the key is repetition. So he kind of goes into how it's very important that in order to get the reps in and to make the habit basically become automatic, you just have to keep doing it frequently. There is no sort of, he kind of explains, like, you know how there's that 21 days of doing something and then it becomes ingrained in you. He says that it's so individual to each person. For one person, it could be 10 days and a habit is so automatic. For other habits, it might take 3 months. You just really have to keep doing it. The fourth law, make it satisfying. What is rewarded is repeated. What is punished is avoided. The consequences are delayed while the rewards are immediate. The cost of your habits are in the present and the cost of your bad habits are in the future. The more immediate pleasure you get from an action, the more strongly you should question whether it aligns with your long-term goals. And this is one of my favorite things that I read. If you get immediate pleasure from something, that is a huge indication that it probably is not aligning with your long-term goals. Okay, so I'm kind of getting like a wrap up. I have to wrap up for this one, but I will come back for next week to talk more about some of the things that I missed. I hope that this was a good kind of beginner because there's so many other topics I want to talk about in this book, like habit tracking, more in detail on breaking bad habits and also on habit contracts. Like, there's just so many insightful things that I missed. But those were some of the main points when it came to like the four main laws that he kind of covers. But I would literally not walk, but run to your bookstore and get this book because it is, I mean, I don't know. I think it was incredible. So I hope that just kind of going through some of my favorite notes that I took would help you in my little review on the book. But yeah, I hope you have a lovely day and go change those habits because literally these little things that we do every day create our identity in our head and who we are as people. So yeah, thank you. And I'll see you guys next week.
Thank you so much for listening to AUP Radio's 28th episode of the semester. If you'd like to hear more, you can tune in here on World Radio Paris every day, Monday through Thursday from 9 to 10 p.m. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or even an idea for a show that you'd like to hear us do, you can DM us on Instagram. We're at AUP Radio. This episode was produced by Nicole DeSante, Clark Marchese, and myself, your host, Kira Roddy. Music by Vicade Studios. Enjoy your night.